Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Simon Phipps joins me. We're going to be talking about Aragon, a way to use blockchain technology to manage an organization. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Simon Phipps. Episode 467 recorded January 17th, 2018. Aragon. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Command Line Heroes, a new podcast from Red Hat. Listen to the epic true tales of the developers, programmers, hackers, geeks, and open source rebels revolutionizing the technology landscape. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit redhat.com/commandlineheroes today. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Solinge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, little projects, projects that you may want to download and play with right after this show, projects you may be using every day and not actually aware of it. Today might be one of both of those. Joining me once again is my lovely and talented co-host, Simon Phipps. Simon, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Randall. It's a pleasure to be back. I'm glad that I'm allowed back after last week.
Yeah, well, everybody's allowed back after the last week because it doesn't get much lower than that. And we are both apparently in the same identical locations, but I have moved. I am wearing a different shirt, but I've showered at least a few times between last week and this week. So I am in my friend's apartment in Tijuana, just south of the border. I can wave in Guillermo's general direction towards the playa over there and wave towards the U.S. over that way. Okay, so there we are. So I had a couple of weeks here to kind of hang out just before my cruise that leaves out of San Diego. And so I thought I might as well, hey, if I'm coming to San Diego on Saturday, I might as well come down a week early and hang out with my friends in Tijuana. So this has been really cool. Your background changed a little bit, though, right? What did you do?
Yeah, I'm in exactly the same space I was last week, but thanks to the miracle agency of IKEA, I now have a completely refurbished office with all the junk on the walls instead of on the floor. And that's what you can see in the background. You've got over this side, you've got my Floss United scarf on the wall. That's the scarf that the Free Software Foundation, OSI, and Software Freedom Conservancy jointly made at OSCON last year to prove that there is no division between the organizations and that people who say free software and open source are something different are crazy people. And there's other mementos scattered around the walls, which when I lean to one side, you'll be able to see.
Okay, well, today's project is about Aragon. Aragon, on its website, claims it was born to bring transparency and independent governance to the forefront of managing an organization. We want to give the users the freedom they deserve to run their lives. And the underlying technology is blockchain. And we probably know blockchain from retail applications like Bitcoin and Ethereum and things like that. And the reason I brought you on this show in particular is because you have a background with Bitcoin, with blockchain. You want to tell us sort of what the technology is and what you think is unique about Aragon's solution to it?
To tell you what's unique about Aragon, I'm going to have to listen to the show because I looked at the website and I was left wondering a little bit what's going on. Blockchain is a distributed ledger. It uses a data structure called a Merkle tree to maintain a linked list of transactions that are cryptographically signed to make sure that they can't be tampered with. And then the trust of the chain is managed by the consensus of a community who all are entitled to add modified blocks to the data structure when they have authorization to do so. That is usually through a proof of work or a proof of identity. So blockchain is the big buzz in the technology industry at the moment. If you go to the IBMs and the Anderson Consultings of this world, they'll all be talking to you about blockchain consulting. It's all extremely hot. There are plenty of people who are very skeptical about blockchain. I recommend a book by an author called David Gerard called Attack of the 50-Foot Blockchain, where David expresses extreme skepticism and classifies most things involving blockchain as Ponzi schemes. So I'll be fascinated looking at this project to find out exactly where they rest. I think there's a very valid technology to be had from blockchains. It looks to me like they're using it to maintain corporate governance for distributed business structures. There's recently been a disastrous distributed business structure called the distributed organization that was done in the Ethereum community. So hopefully that there'll be some comment about why this isn't that. But I'm really looking forward to finding out about the project and digging in and understanding if there's any there.
Well, our guest today is Louis Quinda. I hope I said that close to right. With his bio, it starts really interesting. It says he started his first free software project, an easy-to-use operating system based on Linux at the age of 12. So this is definitely somebody who's been around this for a while, which is also pretty cool. And we will be bringing him on in just a minute. But before we do that, I have a very important announcement. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Command Line Heroes, a brand-new original podcast for geeks, by geeks, from Red Hat. Command Line Heroes is dedicated to telling the epic true tale of the developers, programmers, hackers, geeks, and open source rebels who are revolutionizing the technology landscape. Yeah, that sounds like they should be interviewing me. I wonder when I'm going to get on that show. What's a command line hero? You might be one if you've ever taken something apart to see how it works, or you'd rather make something instead of just using it. Command line heroes are the makers, builders, dreamers, and doers who are transforming tech and shaping our tomorrows. Command line heroes is produced by Red Hat, an open source company that started in an apartment 25 years ago and knows a thing or two about where tech comes from and where it's going. And it's hosted by Saran Yitbarek, a developer who founded Code Newbie, hosts two other tech podcasts, and lives and breathes open source software. Here's what you're going to hear. Each episode goes deep on a topic that we techies care about. The first season alone covers the OS wars, going back to the 80s, how Linux came to be, covering the desktop front, and battle for the data center. The development of the agile movement, the story of DevOps, and those doing combat in the cloud. And that's just the start. Visit redhat.com/commandlineheroes. Subscribe to Command Line Heroes wherever you get your podcasts. And visit redhat.com/commandlineheroes for extras and to learn more. That's redhat.com/commandlineheroes. And we thank Command Line Heroes and Red Hat for sponsoring today's Floss Weekly. And now let's go ahead and bring on our guest, Louis. I'll see if I get this right again. Louis Quinda, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Great. And so give us the... Oh, where are you speaking to us from?
From my house. We all work remote, so it's my house in Madrid.
Oh, in Madrid. Okay, so in Spain. Yeah, so that's why there's a slight delay as we talk back and forth to each other. That's fine. We're used to that. We can do that. So give us a 30,000-foot view. What is Aragon? What problem is Aragon trying to solve?
So the promise of Aragon is that it will bring an easy way for people to run decentralized organizations. And a decentralized organization is basically a kind of organization which doesn't require a government or any corporate or proprietary centralized entity to run itself. But, you know, you can just run it with any computer that, you know, can sync blockchain. So that's the idea. And it's very similar to how, free software communities are run. But with the power of smart contracts, we can enforce some rules on the blockchain, so you can make sure that, you know, if you have an ownership of, for example, a company, you actually have that ownership on the blockchain and no one can remove that from you, even a malicious actor or even a government.
And so, yeah, but hasn't this already been solved? I mean, first off, you know, Bitcoin was already a way to do that, sort of, and it actually has a result in generating money and providing financial transactions. And Ethereum, I thought, was an advancement on that, so that you could actually provide smart contracts. What does Aragon bring to the table that's more improved even than Ethereum?
Yeah, we actually use Ethereum, and Ethereum is a great platform for smart contracts. But what we are building is the actual solution, the actual product that you can use to, like, you know, set up any kind of organization, which can be like a company, and you can like give shares to your employees or stuff like that, or you can create your nonprofit, or you can even create your own free software project and then, you know, create a new token that is the governance token for the free software project. And then contributors or maintainers can get that token or buy it in the free market and then provide funding for the project. It really gets really modular, but the core mission is to provide like a super easy desktop app that you download and you can start your organization and collaborate with others in a very easy way with your like cap table and with your like voting or governance scheme and with your accounting software all integrated into one interface.
But would it be fair to say then that Ethereum is providing sort of the assembly language, but isn't really providing the code? And so what Aragon has to do is actually write the code that is implemented by the Ethereum smart contract?
I mean, yeah, I could say that Ethereum is the computer, and we are implementing like both Linux and both like a beautiful like user interface to use it, like a desktop environment. That would be the analogy.
Well, aren't there already quite a few players in this space?
Yeah, there are, I mean, in the blockchain space, there are a lot of players, but there are like only a couple that are doing something similar to what we're doing. So we don't really like focus too much on competition. Like I would say we are the only ones that have something that works along those lines, because there was like a huge fiasco called, you guys just mentioned it, like the DAO fiasco, like 2 years ago, in which the first distributed organization was deployed on the wild, and it got attacked and it got, you know, robbed, and that was a huge fiasco. And after that, nobody like tried to touch the concept again until we like came around and, you know, basically had the balls to say, you know, the concept was right. Maybe the implementation was not, but the concept was right, and we want to like do it right.
And how did you get started with this? How did you get involved?
It's a very funny history. So my co-founder and me, we met like, you know, via Twitter when we were like 14 and 15. And then we've been working together for some years. But last year, well, the year before, 2016, we were working on this project called Unpatent, which was like a way to basically eradicate patent trolls. That was our mission, to like eradicate patent trolls. And that was a very hard mission for a lot of things. One of them is that it has a lot of legal implications. And at one point, we figured out that the problem was not the patent system. The problem was the governance. The problem was that, you know, there are huge lobbies that make the patent system, you know, not change at all. And that wasn't only for the patent system. That was for mostly everything. You know, the governments are very corrupt. And so we figured out that the right thing to do would be to create this way for people to organize without having to go through a government or a bank or a notary. And so therefore, there wouldn't be that mass corruption in the world. So that was how we got started.
Okay, and let me then clarify then. So is Aragon a labor of love for the people that are involved, or are you planning a company around this? Or, I mean, how is it proceeding? How are you going to fund the work on this?
It's basically an open source project, and we have a foundation, which is a nonprofit, and that nonprofit did a token sale back in May last year, and that was a very successful token sale, so we have funds to like develop the project for the time being. And right now, we have like this legal entity holding the funds, but we want to transition all the project governance to the community completely, so there will be like voting, democracy, or other systems of governance, and people in the community will be able to vote what to do with the funds, and we plan to transition all those funds to the community for them to manage them.
So, Lewis, I think we're going to talk about some things during the show that listeners will need explaining to them. So I gave an incredibly vague description of blockchain technology at the beginning of the show. We've talked about smart contracts here. Would you like to give me your explanation of what a smart contract is?
Sure. So for those that know a little bit about programming, you know, programming in some form kind of resembles the legal world. Like, you know, you have a contract, and that contract has different like clauses and has different like edge cases. And that's very similar to how you code. Like, you know, if whatever, then whatever else, right? So smart contracts are a way to reach consensus on basically having these very complicated like contracts, but instead of writing them in like, you know, English or the language, you write them in code, and then they are automatically enforced by all the nodes in a blockchain. So basically all the nodes in a blockchain talk the same programming language, and they are able to know what's the outcome of a given contract. So for example, I can do like a bet, and I can code a contract in which it says that at a given date, it should check, you know, what's the outcome of that bet, of that, for example, you know, football result or whatever. And then automatically the blockchain and the nodes in the blockchain will check that result and will say, you know, the bet was won by this party or this other party. And so there is no dispute at all, because, you know, it's just code and it's like written in stone forever. So I would say it's a mix between programming languages and law in some way. It's programmable law. Okay.
So, I mean, I explained a different way. I say that a smart contract is a computer program that is stored in the blockchain and executes when certain conditions or events arise. And those conditions or events usually relate to objective parameters. And the fact it's stored in the blockchain means the code is immutable. It can't be changed by anybody. And the fact that it's triggered by events means that it can't be started or stopped arbitrarily by anybody unless those events come about. Would you say that's a reasonable explanation? It's a computer program that's event-driven and stored in the blockchain?
I mean, that's an awesome explanation. And also the fact that it's unstoppable is very remarkable too. So yeah, that's an awesome explanation.
So I don't know if you've read the book that I was referring to at the beginning of the show. The author of that book is fairly skeptical about smart contracts, and I have to tell you that I'm very skeptical about smart contracts as well. I've dealt with a lot of contracts in my career, and very rarely have the problems surround them arisen from the objective facts. The problems that surround them usually arise from the subjective judgment of the human beings who define the facts or define the process. And the problem that I can see with a smart contract-based activity is that if there's a bug, you can't fix it. You can only, at best, you can disable the program. You can't fix the bug. And if there's a dispute about the nature of one of the events, you can't resolve it because the program is already in there. And it seems to me that that was why the DAO crashed and burned spectacularly. It was because there was a bug in the program no one could fix, and it gave everyone's money away to the first person who noticed how to exploit it. So why are smart contracts a good way to run an organization? It seems that a human oversight is a much better way to go than a potentially buggy, immutable program.
Yeah, I mean, those two concerns are like the biggest concerns right now, I would say, in the smart contracts. And, you know, a smart contract tries to reduce trust. Like right now, a lot of things are run by trust. For example, you trust the nation state with probably like most parts of your life, and you trust your bank for, you know, keeping your money and your balances and all of that. While a smart contract, you can actually verify what the code does. The issue, as you said, is that smart contracts are not upgradable by default. So you have a buggy program, and you have a buggy program forever. So that is fixed now, thankfully, using multiple upgradability mechanisms like the one we have built at Aragon. You can basically upgrade the smart contracts, but then the question is, who can upgrade that? And that's what governance kicks in, for example, the DAO. In the case of the DAO, it could be really cool if all the DAO token holders could actually vote to upgrade the smart contract. Because, you know, if it's only a single person that can trigger that update, like a root user or something like that, then it's not very different from having all the trust in a single entity like a bank. But you have a governance system which can actually, you know, put the stakeholders together for a vote, then, you know, you can roll out a new version of the contract and fix that. So I believe that upgradability could be kind of a solved problem. And then there's the second problem, which is, you know, contracts are subjective by default. And so what I believe is that obviously you cannot encode all of the humans, like, you know, subjectiveness into a piece of code. But what you can do is you can cover most of the like very basic stuff, and then you can leave some form of arbitration to humans to resolve. So something that we've been researching a lot at Aragon is how can we create a decentralized court system, like a court system in which you can have judges. And then if something in a smart contract is not working as intended, then you can open a dispute, you know, stake some money into it. And then if the dispute is resolved, you earn the other part's money. And if not, your money has been taken by the system. So that's something very interesting. And I think like most smart contracts will have to sort of like, you know, last resort to a court system or to that decentralized court system where things don't work out of the box.
Right. I should say for listeners, if this is all very buzzword intense for you, you can go read about the DAO experiment on Wikipedia. It has a really good summary of it. DAO is spelled DAO. It's an acronym standing for Decentralized Autonomous Organization. And there's a really good summary of what happened there on Wikipedia if you'd like to take a look. So, Luis, what are you using the blockchain for? Is this all about a tradable token and the an extension of the Bitcoin gold rush, or is this about a ledger that is recording entity transactions like hiring and firing staff and the ownership of physical resources? What are you using the blockchain for in this environment?
So in this environment, we're using it for reaching consensus on what's reality, really. Because if you think about it, if you have a company, for example, and you open a company in a nation state, like you open a U.S. company, for example, then the U.S. is kind of, there is a registry that you open a company that, you know, those are the founders, and the U.S. has the absolute truth over what happened. But for enabling decentralized organizations, we shouldn't be trusting on any government or nation state or, you know, bank, or whatever. So we need a way to reach consensus on what's reality. And that's what blockchain really gives you. It's a consensus on what's reality. And, you know, in Bitcoin, for example, it's how, you know, how many Bitcoins you own. That's the consensus that the whole network is reaching. And you cannot double spend, things like that. And Ethereum is much more complex because of the nature of the smart contracts. But for example, in our case, we're just using it for the consensus on what are the things that you own and what are the things that you have electronically signed, what are the things that you have agreed, you know, with others. So it's basically a way to have a registry, almost like a notary, right? A notary has a registry, a notary public has a registry of all the things that you have agreed to. So it's a very similar use case. And I mean, it's not something about the Bitcoin gold rush or stuff like that. It's just that this wasn't possible before, and now with the blockchain, it's just right. Possible.
So the Pirate Party has been dabbling with electronic applications of democracy. They have a system, a philosophy that they called liquid feedback, and that's part of a thing they call liquid democracy. Is this in any way related to liquid democracy?
Yeah, totally. I mean, one of the systems that you can implement with this kind of blockchain-based voting is liquid democracy, or you can even implement very kind of science fiction governance systems. Like my favorite one is called Footarchy. So Footarchy consists, and also like has a Wikipedia entry, like a very interesting one if you guys want to look it up, but basically consists on setting up like a prediction, and then you have two outcomes. For example, you have one outcome, which would be Donald Trump winning the elections will be great for the you know, US economy. And you have the contrary one. You have one which is Donald Trump will actually, you know, produce a very bad impact on the US economy. And then people can vote on one or the other one. And then you can let like a year or 2 year pass. And then, you know, if A was proven, then you reward the people who voted A. And in the contrary, if B is proven, then you reward people who have voted A, and you punish the other part, you punish the voters of A. So you can really get crazy with this kind of very complex governance systems, and liquid democracy is the one that we are, like, you know, first experimenting with. Like, I would say we will be able to do liquid democracy on the blockchain in like a month or 2 months.
Right. And is the Pirate Party, or are there any other political parties picking that up and wanting to run with it?
I don't think so for now, at least. This is happening just like, you know, in communities and open source projects and like blockchain projects for now.
Okay. So the other question that springs to mind in such a human critical application, one of the questions you have to ask is, how do you know when it's ready, and how do you know you're right that it's ready? Because, I mean, it's always struck me that Bitcoin was an experiment that got out of the lab early and is still alive, you know, a decade later. So isn't this very risky stuff? Aren't you likely to start running with something which is going to turn out to be broken like Bitcoin has?
It is very, very tricky. And, I mean, we haven't spent many, many months before releasing something that can actually be pushed to, like, you know, production and have, like, millions of dollars in the, you know, of a skin in the game. And we'll probably have some more months for testing. But I mean, you know, just pushing things like Bitcoin forward, I don't think it makes any damage to the world. Like, Bitcoin has done a lot of good and has worked great for the past, you know, 9 years already. And I mean, it will continue to evolve. And it's just like free software, you know, things continue to evolve. There are new versions out. The community, you know, has a new direction. So they take out and start a new direction. They can fork it. That's the good thing about the blockchain. And about open source in general, you can just fork it and do your own fork of it. But I think it's very risky because, like, with the blockchain, you are coordinating thousands of, you know, of persons at once. So especially when there's a lot of money in stake, we should be very conscious about, you know, making sure that these systems are fair from a societal point of view. For example, in the case of Bitcoin, I won't consider that success because like 90-something percent of the supply is owned by, you know, very few people. So that's not what we want.
Right, right. So do you think open source is actually a safe way to develop software here? So I'm the last person to say that open source is a bad idea, given the jobs that I have. But I note that the core philosophy of open source is release early, release often. And the reason you can do that is you can always fix your bugs later. And it's far better to get the bugs out so you can fix them than to keep them in house so that they can fester. But in a situation like this, where every release of software is a matter of economic life and death at best, a possibly real life and death at worst. Is it really safe to have an open source environment where any developer can push to production? Surely you need to have a benevolent dictator for life on software like this.
Well, the funny thing is, first of all, it needs to be open source, because when you are interacting with these systems, like, you know, you're interacting with a smart contract, you either know, you know, what the code of the contract is, or you would basically be interacting with a black box and sending your money to a black box that can do whatever it wants. So it needs to be open source. And that's very interesting for me. Like, it's an ecosystem that is just open source by default. And then regarding the governance of the projects, like in the beginning, it's great to just have this sort of like benevolent dictatorship. But then when you start migrating away to something that is more decentralized, that's where the magic happens. Like, you know, in the case of Bitcoin, there is not a single party that can, like, you know, push out a version that has some backdoor or stuff like that. And then it's true that, you know, as any software, you can really have critical bugs. But if you have a lot of, you know, money in stake, the chances of that happening really, you know, go lower and lower, such as, you know, in the case of Bitcoin, which hasn't had any major bugs in a lot of time.
So I'm curious, I'll ask more of the techie questions. What's this written in?
You mean Aragon?
Yeah.
Well, it's part of it is Solidity, which is the, smart contract language for Ethereum. And the front end is all JavaScript and React and, you know, the usual, like, you know, web stack.
Okay, well, I see NPM's involved, so I'm wondering if parts of it is in JavaScript.
Yeah. Yeah, I always say most of it is in JavaScript and then Solidity and then, that's it.
What's the other word you're saying? Solidity?
Yeah, Solidity is the programming language for smart contracts in Ethereum, one of them.
And earlier you brought up the notion of having a bet that would depend on the outcome of something. How does data get into the smart contracts to make an influence on the decision?
There are two ways of doing that. If you have the result of the prediction on chain, like, for example, it's, you know, if someone will pay some bitcoins to another address or stuff like that, then it's very easy because the smart contract can just read the blockchain. But then if it's something like, you know, the weather that's physical, that's outside of the blockchain, outside of, you know, the computers, then you would need what's called an oracle, which is someone or a network of computers that can, you know, monitor the weather and attest what the weather was at that given time.
But that means you then have to trust some entity then outside the blockchain to provide data that's reliable. And it sounds like we're right back to the first problem.
Yeah, then the solution for that is basically creating the right cryptoeconomic incentives. So if, for example, one of these oracles cheat, then they are heavily punished and, you know, they are taking away some stake or some Ether or Bitcoin that they put aside for participating in the network.
And it looks like this project's been around for about a year and it's had a bunch of commits in the beginning and then it sort of petered out. Is that because it's getting better, so there's less work to do, or because you don't have the resources to actually finish this up?
No, I mean, we, like, the level of commits that we are having right now is like crazy. We had an interval of like a couple of months in which we were just building out the team, because like right after the token sale that was in May last year, we were only like 2 people in the team, and now we are 10 people. So, like, you know, the pace has really been increasing up a lot for the last like 3 or 4 months.
And Simon just whispered in my ear, and actually it's a good point. So when you talk about if it's decided that it's cheating, well, who decides that it's cheating?
So you can have a network of, like, you know, computers or a smart contract checking that very easily. So, for example, if you have like five oracles that are checking the weather, and one of them is not really giving you accurate information in regards to what the other fours are saying, then if the cryptoeconomics are setting in the right way, then you could assume that fifth oracle is cheating you. Of course, you can really get crazy with the cryptoeconomic incentives as this, but that's basically one of the like easiest ways to know whether someone is cheating or not.
Okay, and so it says on the front page, everything in this repo is highly experimental software and shouldn't be used for real-world applications. How will you know when you're done?
Well, I mean, we're never done, but I think we will be ready for releasing something that can be used in the wild in the next couple of months. And I mean, how can we know? I would say the answer is audits. Like, we are spending a lot of money into security audits, and that's right now that's the best way to actually know if a piece of software, like, you know, works in the blockchain or not. Because, you know, as you guys know, like, you publish something in the blockchain and it has a bug, and then, you know, you get robbed, and that's about it. So we are being very, very careful about it.
And are you dogfooding it? Are you actually using this to manage your internal organization?
Yeah, we're going to start paying payroll next month using Aragon. So totally. If we screw it up, then we don't get paid.
That's a perfect incentive, I guess. That's great. That's great. Let me see. I'm just looking at my list of notes here. This language, the language of Ethereum, I imagine it can't be Turing complete because that has the halting problem, right?
Well, I mean, it is Turing complete, or it was supposed to be Turing complete. There are a couple of cases which don't really make it fully Turing complete, because, like, as you said, like, that's one of the cases that they want to avoid. And you also have to, like, pay for the usage. So there is this concept called gas. So the gas is the amount of Ethereum that you have to pay for executing a call to a smart contract. So basically, you avoid a lot of spam attacks.
And so if it's not Turing complete, what are some of the operations that are available? And I just want to, you know, I know my audience is probably a little confused right now. What are the kinds of things that are in this language? Does it have decisions and iterations and the ability to gather data? Does it have data structures?
I mean, it is Turing complete, but there are a couple of things that you cannot do, which you can do in, like, fully Turing complete languages, like, I don't know, infinite loops. Like, you cannot do an infinite loop in Solidity, like with Ethereum, because, you know, you have to pay for computation, and therefore you will have to pay, like, infinite computation for it. So there are things that you cannot do, like, you know, infinite loops, which, anyway, I don't know what would you like to, like, do an infinite loop, but anyway, that you cannot do that.
So, Luis, it's all fascinating stuff. I'm now full of questions about the token. So you're using Ethereum, so you're using Ethers, but you have a token of your own for the project, I believe.
Yeah, it's called AMT, Aragon Network Token.
And what is that token? Is that simply a mapping onto Ethereum, or is it a proof of work or a proof of identity token? What is it?
So it's a token built on Ethereum, so it doesn't need its own, like, consensus layer, because we depend on Ethereum for the blockchain. Let's say that Ethereum is the computer and we are just, like, you know, building one token on top of that computer. And the token represents, I mean, not right now because we are still working on it, but it will represent the governance over the Aragon project. So basically, people will have control over the things that we do in the project. I mean, not even that we do, that the project does. Like, for example, one of the things that we want to do is transition all the funds that we have, or most of the funds that we have from the token sale, to this decentralized organization, and then let people with a token decide what to do with it. Like, what's the best way to run the project, and what's the best allocation of funds?
Right. So these tokens, are they going to get traded? I mean, the main thing that seems to have happened in most blockchain projects is that, regardless of the actual purpose of the token and the project, it's ended up being a speculative exchange for investors.
Yeah, I mean, this is very similar to, I wasn't alive in the 90s to, like, you know, see this happen, but I was told by some friends that, like, this is very similar to the bubble, or, you know, dot-com bubble in the 90s, in the sense that there was a lot of speculation, and a lot of those, you know, the speculation that happened didn't go anywhere, but there was actually some speculation that, you know, funded the very critical research for a lot of things that we have today in terms of the web 2.0 and all of that. So I think it's kind of very similar. Like, there's a lot of speculation going on, but that's wonderful because it funds a lot of very high quality projects. And also there are a lot of scams. Like, that's the bad side of it. But definitely there's a lot of speculation happening.
Right. So doesn't it worry you, bringing that world of amoral ethical vacuum to the world of human governance? Don't you think that the speculation is likely to influence the politics and the life outcomes?
Yeah, it's very hard because governance at the end is just about trading the short-term incentives for the long-term and teaching people that, or incentivizing people to take actually better decisions for the long-term rather for the short-term profit. So I'm obviously worried about it, but I think it's more like a challenge in terms of governance, and I would love to solve it, because if we're able to solve that, you know, governance challenge, then it's applicable for a bunch of other things, and we're able to incentivize people to look for the long term and not just make a quick buck.
Right. So I'm an old guy. I've got one of my parents still alive. He's a very old guy. And my kids are quite old. They're becoming old people. Many of the people I've just mentioned are very worried about using technology in their lives. They would really rather not have a phone. Is a world where things are governed by code, where the assumption is that every user has got the skills and the motivation to check that it's not cheating them, not a world that marginalizes and excludes a vast portion of the population?
Yeah, I think so. And that's why, like, user experience is so important in the blockchain, because with the internet, we have to explain people that they can pay with their, like, you know, credit card and stuff like that, and they can do that online. With blockchain, we have to explain them that they can interact with the stuff online, and also that they can, like, they have to store their own, like, private key, they can be their own bank and all of that. Like, there isn't even an analogy to use. So that's very important and requires a lot of education. We're trying to find a lot of education and a lot of, like, different tutorials and stuff like that. Because otherwise, it's not going to be fair. Otherwise, like, you know, the top people are going to, like, the top technology advanced people are going to get into the blockchain first and monopolize it, and that's it. And that's not obviously what we want, because, you know, this thing is very much needed in countries where they don't even know how to use the internet properly, like, you know, third world countries and stuff like that. So we should focus on those before trying to focus on, you know, very technological markets that probably don't need it because they have less corruption and they have, you know, better systems of governance.
Right. So I'm very interested. A lot of people are following a vision that they've got from reading fiction or from reading economists or from reading philosophers. What would you say is giving you a vision for the future? Is it something like Cory Doctorow's Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom or the World of Waffy? Or is it something like Snow Crash? What is it that's painting your vision for the future?
Yeah, I mean, I watch a lot of sci-fi movies, but I would say that there is a book that really influenced me, and that was The Sovereign Individual. It's a book that kind of foresees the whole blockchain and decentralization revolution before it even existed, like back in the 90s. And it's really an awesome book. The first 50 pages kind of talk about how the world will look like in terms of decentralization and why it's totally unstoppable. And I'm very, like, I'm heavily influenced by that book.
Right. So do you think that the decentralization inherently requires decentralized organizations, or is there a place for citizens pooling together their will to create a centralized government?
Well, the problem with centralization is that, you have a lot of power in a central place, then it becomes a single point of failure, and it either corrupts and destroys itself, or it's very easy to attack and, you know, be destroyed from the outside. So I think decentralization is the answer to a lot of these problems. And, you know, why have trust in humans that can get corrupt, where you can put a lot of that work into computers, because at least for now, we know computers don't get corrupt very easily.
Oh. Yeah, let's not even think about Meltdown there, you know, where it turns out that every CPU has got a spy in the cab. It doesn't worry you that every Intel processor has a ring minus one and a ring minus three, where there's processes happening that you can't see.
I cannot sleep thinking about that.
this is what concerns me. Is, you know, I've read a reasonable amount of fiction, as science fiction as well, and most of it ends up being dystopian. So I love Cory Doctorow's books. If you've not read them, I absolutely recommend you go read his books, because he's a prophet of the digital age, I would say. But go read Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. It's a reputation economy, distributed reputation economy. And that's the world that I think that you're leading us towards, is that world of a distributed reputation economy. And honestly, when I read it in the book, it doesn't appeal very much. I have to ask myself, who builds the roads? Who who employs the army, you know? Yeah. And answering those questions is diagnostic of our freedom, in my view.
I mean, yeah, totally. And I think there are two possible outcomes with technology at this point. One of them is we end up, you know, going down the rabbit hole in terms of not having privacy and, you know, not being able to choose what we really want. And that's the path that, you know, technology is leading us towards right now with Amazon, Google, and all of these, you know, proprietary software companies. And that's a world that I don't want to live in, because if you don't have privacy, you end up not being able to have choice because of, you know, machine learning advancements, and they can basically predict what you're going to do before you're doing it. And that's terrible. And then the other approach is we live in a world where power is much more decentralized and everything is more transparent, and we are able to regain control of our own privacy and take back our freedom. And I mean, of course, dystopia and utopia go very hand by hand, but I'm very comfortable thinking of a future where we decentralize power as much as possible, so there is not a single point of failure and we are able to take back our privacy. But of course, like, I'm very worried about ending up in a dystopian future and, you know, helping, you know, go humanity towards it. So, I mean, Intel Meltdown and this other topic are the things that don't let me sleep at night.
Okay, so I'm still a little concerned about this being another way to use blockchains, because we've seen this week in particular the Bitcoin meltdown, and also we're at the point now with 10 or 12 years of transactions, I forget the exact number, but where it takes 3 days for something to settle, you know, and costs money. I mean, I heard a horror story just the other day where somebody took a Bitcoin wallet and wanted to buy $12 worth of Bitcoin, charged up, and it turns out that was less than the transaction cost. So we actually got -3 essentially because it was too expensive to even do the transaction. Won't all these blockchains eventually choke themselves to death?
The difficulty with the size of the blockchain, Randall, is I think a design flaw in the original Bitcoin architecture. I don't think it's inherent in blockchain. I think it's entirely possible to have subchains and to have parallel trees and to have other approaches to building the Merkle tree that contains the blockchain architecture. It was an artifact of the way that Bitcoin worked that in order to participate in the blockchain, you needed to have a complete copy of it. And in addition, a complete copy of it was inevitably going to end up being enormous in the future. But I don't think that's an inherent part of having a blockchain. I don't think that's a problem that Ripple or Ethereum are going to have, because they saw it coming, they learned the lesson, and they've programmed it out. So I don't think that's really my concern with blockchains. I think I'm much more concerned about the two aspects, one of them being that there's a value commodity that is going to be speculated with, and people are going to be speculating both on the commodity and on derivatives of the commodity, creating a zombie economy like is crippling the world at the moment. And then the second problem is going to be with smart contracts, where the idea of immutable code automatically executing strikes me as a lesson we ought to have learned from 2001: A Space Odyssey. So those are the things that really concern me. The scalability of the blockchain doesn't worry me too much.
I think we'll just go ahead and finish up the show on that thought, which is probably a scary thought, but it's still probably a good place to quit, I guess, there. So let's talk about who's coming up on the show. Next week is WireGuard, which is a modern VPN, faster, simpler, leaner, more useful than IPsec. That's a big challenge to make, so we'll see how they can pull that off. Following is NanoMessage, which is a fork of 0MQ, learning from the mistakes that were made in 0MQ. So we've got one of the developers coming in from that. Process Maker, which is a workflow manager. Scan Code, which is what it says, scans code, detects licenses, copyrights, package manifests, and dependencies. Then my good friend Jim Brandt's coming on. He's the head of the Perl Foundation right now. He's going to talk about the state of Perl 5, Perl 6, the Perl Foundation, Perl projects, Perl everything, all things Perl. So for those of you that out there keep screaming at me and saying, you don't have enough Perl on this show, you're the Perl guy, why don't you bring Perl on the show? So we've got the head dude, Mr. Jim Brandt himself. Following that, GitLab, the open source GitHub, local or hosted. Gitcoin just added to the schedule last week. It's the easiest way to monetize or incentivize Floss work. That's going to be cool. And then also just added to the schedule, Alan Clark's going to talk to us about SUSE. I can't believe we haven't done a show that's actually on SUSE, and I'm probably mispronouncing that. Sorry. It's SUSE? SUSE?
SUSE.
Sousa. Well, I've been saying that wrong for years. And okay. Anyways, he's going to talk to us about that. That'll be great. If you want to see who's coming up, go to twit.tv/floss. That's the homepage for this show. And the big spreadsheet is linked from there about upcoming guests. If you have any other suggestions, please tell the project leader or community coordinator to email me. We're actually full up to just about the end of March, which is really good. I'm glad to have this, not like eight shows in the can right now. But I'm going to open up April and May, probably between now and next week. We have a live stream. We take a number of questions from there. Actually, we took a question, but it didn't. Oh yeah, no, I guess I didn't actually ask that question. We didn't need to, I was going to ask him that right after this, but okay. we have a live stream. We take a number of questions in there. This week, the number was zero, but it's always a number of questions. 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays is when we tape this, and it's live at twit.tv. You can watch us and goof off behind the scenes, because that's always a lot of fun. You can follow us at Floss Weekly on Google Plus and at Floss Weekly on Twitter. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus and at Merlin on Twitter. I am going to be on a cruise ship for the next 2 weeks, but I have put the show in the very capable hands of my co-host, so the show will go on. Simon, I think you're actually taking one of the hosting spots on that, right?
I think I've got one of those coming up, yes. I forget which one it is. I'm sure somebody is going to tell me.
Well, I'll still be sending out the rundowns. Don't worry. I'll still be managing the show from the boat. But I just the internet speed and the cost of the internet kind of prevent me from doing this show while I'm out at sea somewhere. So I'm actually starting in San Diego, going through the Panama Canal, ending up in Fort Lauderdale. I think I'm here hit Colombia and about six places in Mexico. So I'll probably be coming right back by here again next Saturday coming up. Yeah, that'd be fun. But the show will go on, so that's fine. I don't really have anything else to plug right now. Oh, I will be at Scale coming up in March. I'm giving a talk on Flutter, which is the language using Dart to actually write iOS and Android apps cross-platform, which is really cool. So I'll be doing a presentation on that. I'm also going to represent Floss Weekly there, look for more guests and things like that. So, Simon, anything you want to plug?
Yeah, well, while you're basking in the Caribbean or the Caribbean, as you say, I am going to be in the icy, wet wastes of Brussels in Belgium for FOSDEM. And I would be delighted to see any listeners and viewers at FOSDEM. I am very honored indeed to be giving a keynote there. I'm giving the opening keynote on the Saturday morning on February the 3rd, celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Open Source Initiative and talking about the history and future of open source. I'm also delighted to be able to say that the non-profit that I founded and that I help administer, Public Software, has recently taken over the administration of the UK's premier free culture conference, OGCamp. And we've been able to announce this year's instance of OGCamp, which is coming up on the 18th of August. We've opened ticket sales for that, and it would be delightful to see you at OGCamp. If you'd like to come along, you should buy your tickets really soon, because they do tend to sell out. Quickest way to find ticket sales is to go into your favorite search engine and search for OGCamp. That's OGGCAMP. And you'll be able to find the ticket sales there. Apart from those two things, life is pretty quiet. I've just got, you know, stuff for 12 to 14 hours a day. Randall, enjoy the cruise.
Yeah, I know what that's like. Well, I'm going to be working on the cruise anyway. I mean, not working like swabbing the decks or anything, but I'm going to be, I'll have my laptop out. And I think they're going to give us a flat rate Wi-Fi plan. And if they are, then I'll probably be online 3 or 4 hours a day anyway, getting stuff moved forward, because I got tons of stuff to keep doing in life. So that's kind of the way that works too. So I understand exactly your 12 to 14 hour day comment, because that sort of feels like my life these days too. So anyway, hey, Simon, great to have you back on the show so quickly, and especially about a topic that I know you really, your knowledge far exceeds anything that I can get in reading quick summaries and things like that. So thanks again for co-hosting the show.
It's been a pleasure. I've been doing this stuff. I read an article about it very early on in the life of Bitcoin, and I've been tracking it ever since, because a whole load of very generous people gave me some. And so I have a vested interest in finding out what goes on. But it isn't really an interest I have to declare, because I haven't spent any money on it. It's just kind of sitting there being Bitcoin and going up and down in value. I talked to my family about today's random number, which I read off from my phone. Today's random number is about 9,800. It's a much lower random number than it was at Christmas.
Oh, yeah. I actually managed to get out of my Bitcoin wallet, which was sitting on my laptop. I managed to get it off into Coinbase. So at least I have 0.05 cents, which is up to $800 for a while. So 0.05 Bitcoin cents, whatever it is. And that was given to me for free back when they were handing them out for free at the beginning, just to have people to have them. So I got this for free. So I I have an $800 value. Well, it was $800. Now it's like $400 value, right?
It'll go up again. Don't worry. And then it'll come down again. I mean, who knows? It's completely random and not anchored to anything in the real world.
Yeah. And once I got set up on Coinbase, I bought $50 worth of Ethereum, and that's up to like $80 now. So that's kind of nice. So that's slick. All slick. There we go. All right. Hey, again, Simon, thank you again. And we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.